So from the accounts point of view, you've got the regulatory framework, you've got the Charities Act as far as it's been enacted, you have the regulations which are bringing in these accounting and reporting rules, you have the Charities SORB, new this year and not necessarily a static document as we maybe had hoped. If you're a limited company, you already have been under the Companies Act 2006 for some time now, so that's not changing at least. And then there's the Charity Commission returns, and that's really just driven by the regulations above. So the main changes in the accounting regulations, and Jenny has already talked about this, and I think the key reminders there are that if you're a limited company, you can't prepare the receipts and payments. And the other thing I would say about that top line there on independent examination by a proper person is that as you get towards the 250,000 income mark, you're going to have real trouble finding a proper person who is not a qualified person or a firm who's going to be prepared to sit and wade through your £250,000 worth of stuff and to sign on the dotted line. And so I think, and I know that if somebody came to me with a charity of that size on a personal basis, I would be very reluctant to do it. So I think you're probably talking about a much lower threshold before you're really looking at talking to a qualified person or a firm. But that's your limit. The next level is then that you're into the SORP, but independent exam. Now, the guidance on independent examination is not being consulted on, I'm told, by the Charity Commission, although they're bringing in a final Section 10, which they may consult on, and there's going to be a Charity Commission event, I think, in March to talk about that subject. And then once you get up into the 500,000 mark, you're then what is termed in the SORP anyway as a larger charity. You're over the audit exemption limit, and you are into those rules. Now, the interesting thing on that one is that in the past, if you have a trading subsidiary, we'll have looked at you, and under the Companies Act, you're not a medium group. And I think that medium group limit has now gone up to a turnover of something like 10 million. But once you become under these regulations, your gross income for the group is 500,000. So if you have a charity with an income of 450,000 and a charity shop that brings in 100,000, then when you add those together, you are over the 500,000 limit. And the other trip, there's a couple of other little tripwires there. When you're counting that 500,000, then you have to add all the organisations together. But the other thing is then that there are changes to the income recognition. So in the past, you may say, well, under the old accounting rules, I am just squeezing underneath. But if you have to start recognising donated goods earlier in your charity shop or something, you may actually find that you're tipped over or getting very close. So the big change, I suppose, in my world is the SORP, the Statement of Recommended Practice. And there are a few changes to the SOFA, the Statement of Financial Activities. And there's an interesting article, actually, last week in Civil Society on non-compliance. Mark Spilforth was writing about non-compliance with the SORP and reasons why that may be. And he does mention, which is something which we would also see as we come across different charities, is that they may have replaced their profit and loss account with the Statement of Financial Activities, but they maybe haven't fully complied with the SORP disclosure notes or with the trustee's annual report at the front, as is set out in the SORP. So it sort of looks like a set of SORP accounts, but it's not quite there yet. And I suppose that's where you come back to the checklist. Cash flow statements under the SORP, which is effective from the 1st of January 15, accounting periods beginning on or after that, there's a cash flow statement. Now, in the past, we all assumed that the SOFA was supposed to include our income and expenditure account and give us an idea of all the movements. It's not like a profit and loss account, and so you maybe didn't need a cash flow. The current view is that the SOFA does not give you all that information, and it's useful to just see those source and application of funds as well. So, but again, that's a slightly fluid one, because that, at the minute, the SORP says all charities who are preparing accruals accounts. Consolidations, then, that's only for those people who have a trading subsidiary. And there are some questions there around whether your trading subsidiary is a trading subsidiary. If you've formed a company limited by guarantee as your trading subsidiary, then there's no shareholder relationship between the two. But I think most people would look at that and say, but you know, even though you don't have a legal connection by a shareholding, you're still part of the same group. So there's probably tripwires in there as well. And as I say, that limit has come a way, way down from the Companies Act limits down to the £500,000 limit. And then there are some new accounting treatments. And everybody's new accounting treatments will be different under the SORP because you all have different kinds of assets, different kinds of liabilities, and different kinds of income. So we're looking at, under certain conditions, fair value of assets or liabilities. There are definitely changes on income recognition. I mentioned there about donated goods and when you have to recognise donated goods as they're given to you. So you may have a charity shop which gets donations and you recognise the income of those as you sell them. But if you can establish a cost on those, then you may have to recognise those. And I say may because it is growing. You may have to recognise those on receipt and count them into your stock at the end of the year. But there's also one on legacies. And it used to be that you weren't encouraged to recognise a legacy too soon. So you had to be almost certain, absolutely pretty definite, that you were going to get that money or have got the receipt from the solicitor before you would recognise a legacy. Now that has been watered down to probable. So if you know that your charity's been named in a will, you know how much money that was supposed to come to you, and it's probable that you will get it. Now there have been legal cases where those have been challenged and wills recently in the news where charities have fought to hang on to their money or indeed family members have got a ruling against it and got some of the money back from the charity. But on the whole then, so you've got a probable there, and I say that's why that you have to look very carefully at your 500,000 limit. And there is also a new concept introduced, which is the mixed motive investment. And the whole idea of investments, I think, is the next hot topic in terms of investment policies and why you hold investments and how you do them. We've been through the pain of people updating their reserves policies. Why do you hold reserves? Why do you need reserves? Do you hold enough or too few? And I think we're now moving on to, do you have too many investments? Are you holding them for the right reason? So an investment is something you hold because you're going to benefit from the income that comes off it or the capital gain, the increase in value. So perhaps a rental property that you used to use and you've moved out of, but you have a tenant in there and you're hoping it'll be worth a bit more before you actually come around to selling it. And then the things that you use in your day-to-day, whether you have a clinic or a hostel or a refuge or something, that's not an investment. That's something you're using to deliver what you do. But there are things in the middle there which you may be using, but you may also be hoping that they'll go up in value before you actually sell them and withdraw from them. And so you have this idea that you own the asset, but you maybe don't need to own the asset. But because you've got it, you're going to hang on to it and try and get a benefit from it. And so there are questions around that. You just need to be aware of that. Now, we, as the accountants, will worry about most of these and worry about the numbers and keep you right on those. So you'll notice that this is not a numbers-heavy presentation, but the information, the calculations, those judgments, those investment policies and things, those are yours and those come from you. And that's the sort of thing we'll be looking for you to help you to incorporate into them into your final financial statements. Now, the SORP is a pretty chunky document, but I've picked out two paragraphs from it, and this is from the introduction. So in paragraph 12 of the introduction, it talks about your audience. It talks about who might be looking at your accounts. And remember, as these are going out in the Charity Commission world, they may have a wider audience. So it's not just the funder who you send a copy to or your financial supporters, your donors who turn up to your AGM. You may also have service users, other beneficiaries, and indeed, in some charities, the staff members and the employees will be interested in what's being reported and what's happening. So that's paragraph 12. Paragraph 13, this talks about the minimum that is required of you. It should help you to understand it. This word resources will crop up time and time again. What resources do you have? And that might mean buildings, it might mean people, it might mean volunteers, it might mean cash in the bank. All those things that you can use and drag together, and what you have, how you have applied those resources in the best interests of your beneficiaries, what's been received there. So, and then the Charity Commission is probably the one I'm least hung up about. There are interim reporting rules. I think this is one you'll have seen in Miles McCune, the head of Compliance Charity Commission, slides regularly, and that's the interim reporting, and that really is just to handle that period between now and once you're into a full year of registration, when you're into these rules fully. So that lets you decide whether you're reporting under the old rules or under the new rules in terms of your accounts and these limits under legislation. There's the statement of your public benefit, and I think that this can all be done in-house, either by the board or by your CEO. If you prepare in advance, you know what you're going to have to do. You gather up all your information, and you go for it. You upload your accounts and what's the rest, and you probably don't need any input from us at that stage. It is important that you know who's going to do it and who's responsible. Don't know. I'm sure a lot of you saw that list of funny excuses that the English Charity Commission published. And it's a big long list of people why they hadn't filed their accounts within the 10 months or filed their report. There was one which came in and said, look, this isn't my responsibility, I'm just a trustee. There was one which said, I'm sorry, I don't have any internet access. And that was received by email. And there was somebody else who'd said that they were driving down the M1 and the car boot had gone open and all their records were somewhere on the M1. But I think the thing, and what I'm talking about preparing is, we talk about the 10-month limit. You talk about the 9-month limit when we're filing at Companies House. You don't have to file on the last day, and please don't. you'll have had your board meeting, you'll have signed your accounts, you'll have approved your reports, you'll have had your AGM. Once you have your AGM, go ahead and get the stuff out there on the public record. And then if there is a hiccup or you find that you try to upload something and it can't, or you can't put your hand on a document, then you've got a few weeks to go around and chase around and get those sorted out. Because we all know charity boards don't meet every day. You do have a time lag in trying to get emails back from people to confirm that they agree with things. So don't leave it to the last minute. But I think what I really want to talk about here is getting away from this bare minimum and back to getting your message across. The whole point of all of this is about telling what happens and what goes on. I'm sorry if people have heard this one before from me, but I quite often talk about the little scout group of which I'm a treasurer. And I do the income and expenditure accounts, and it's a list of the checks that I've written for County Flag Camp, the Tow Camp, coasteering, mountaineering. And an awful lot of checks that are written for chocolate and marshmallows and sausages and anything you can melt in front of a campfire or a gas stove or I think maybe under the grill in the church hall. And so I present this at the parents' meeting of the year, and it is a list of numbers, and some people understand that. It means a lot to me because I'm an accountant and I understand that all the money has come in for these different activities and all the others have gone out. And so that I understand what's going on. But the group scout leader, then, he produces a slideshow, and it's got photographs of boys and girls who haven't changed their clothes in 5 days because it's too cold in the tent, and they're covered in smoke, and they've got, you know, a marshmallow in one hand and a sausage in the other, or the other kids that haven't managed to get dressed outside a tent, standing there in their pyjamas. And the parents then immediately, the parents understand that graphical, pictorial representation. I remember my kid going to that camp. I remember my kid going to that camp. They didn't remember it whenever I was saying, do you remember the county flag that we won? They didn't really remember it, but they remember the photographs. So it's all about how you get that message across, and the numbers are only part of it. Now, the charity SORP is the only accounting standard. Now, SORP, hang on a second here. Just look at this. We talk about the charity SORP a lot. And the SORP is a statement of recommended practice. Now, the Financial Reporting Council issue all sorts of accounting standards, and then for bodies which maybe don't comply with that general trading profit-making thing, they give a different statement of recommended practice. So one is the charity SORP. This is my printed-out copy. That's double-sided. So that's the SORP. And it is based, as you'll know, on FRS 102, because it's called the Charity SORP FRS 102. And FRS 102 is this nice document that's also printed out double-sided. I didn't print out the Companies Act 2006 because it's just huge. But that's an insight into my exciting world. But it's the only accounting standard which actually says what you have to put into your trustee's annual report. If you go into a trading company, it doesn't say in FRS 102 what a trading company has to put into that report. That's all guided by the legislation, what should be in a trustee's report, what should be in a strategic report for a medium company. And that is because the SORP committee really, really recognises the importance of the narrative, the slideshow, the pictorial representations, and whatever else. The activities of the charity probably cannot be told in numbers alone. And I've spoken to a couple of members on the committee that wrote the SORP. You know, they're great pains to point out that there is a real narrative need. Commercial companies are different. Commercial companies, you can see what their turnover was, their profitability, their turnover, their tax. Those are all good measures of achievement of whether a company is going up or down, because that exists only to make profits for our increased value of its shareholders. It's not doing what you're doing. Charities will aim to break even or maybe make a small surplus. In fact, so many are keen to spend all their income on their activities that they find it very hard to build up reserves. And the SOFA will tell us whether the income exceeded the expenditure or not. But it doesn't really give you the picture of whether the money was spent well, what the effectiveness, what the outcomes were. And it could have all been spelt really badly. And it also doesn't tell you what an awful lot of charities are good at, which is turning very small amounts of money or people time or something into a huge impact in a particular sector. And that's where the narrative comes in. Now, there was a great article in Spectator recently on five questions the kids' company should have been asked. And it was actually Maeve Monaghan over here from the Now Project who shared it on LinkedIn, which is how I picked it up. And I'm going to try not to talk about the kids' company in particular, but the questions I think are relevant to all of us when we're looking at what we report and how we report it. And those questions are, who uses the charity? What's it there for? And who are the actual individuals? Now, in the kids' company, those were kids who were falling between the cracks under the radar and maybe being missed somewhere by the welfare state and people who couldn't be reached anywhere else. And then the journalists went on to talk about what the users think. And a lot of the journalists in the aftermath of this have been crawling around talking to actual kids who have received trainers or money or help. And on the programme the other night, they were talking to the girl who was sent to boarding school and what they have got out of it and how it has helped them get out. And in some cases, those users were saying, it's been a waste of money, I just got my money and went and spent it on drink or drugs or whatever. And then other ones were saying, well, I took the money and I went and I bought, you know, food for my little brother or my little sister or something because my mum and dad had spent all their benefits on drugs. So there's the question about what the users think, and I know that some charities in the room here are very good at getting that feedback and doing those evaluations of the outcomes from their beneficiaries. How effective the charity is in the medium and long term, and that comes down to a dependency thing, whether you're creating dependence. There are some people who will always be dependent and will always need the charity, but there are other charities where it's a matter of supporting people and helping them get back on their feet or get back to where they are or to find an employment which is suitable to them or whatever it is. Is the charity actually required? And I think this is one of the things that the regulator will be looking at as new charities come along to register. Are there 10 charities in Belfast all doing the same thing and am I trying to register an 11th? You know, and if you're just duplicating and doing, you might be better just doing a whole lot of fundraising and giving it to somebody who's already doing it. And again, you raise the question, if the charity isn't actually needed, why has it been set up? What are you doing? And are you actually helping the situation? Or are you just pumping money around the system for your own entertainment? And the last question I found quite difficult until I read some of the examples, and it was about, does it put the people it helps first? And this was more along the lines of, do you run your charity to help people when it suits you? You know, there's no point in a homelessness charity that closes its doors over the week over Christmas because everybody's gone home for Christmas and it's people are left in the street. There's no point, Joe, if the SOS bus shut up at 8:30 on a Saturday evening and went home because everybody wanted to be safely in their beds by 9 o'clock and ignored the fact that the kids would be pouring out onto the street at midnight in need of your help. So it's to do with timing, and are you there at the right time and at the right place to help the people you're claiming to help? You know, we hear a lot about the health service at the moment and the fact that people don't get sick 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, and we're supposed to have doctors and hospitals on Saturdays and Sundays, and it's the same thing. Are you there when the people need you? Now, the SORP says that larger charities will need to provide more information. So there's a standard for what needs to go into your trustee's annual report for all charities, and then larger charities, those being over the 500,000, have to give a bit more detail about risks and thoughts and benefits. But regardless of size, if you send your accounts to donors, funders, members, as well as filing it for the general public scrutiny at the charity commission or company's house, then you might not want to hold back to that bare minimum. We're not in the business of bare minimum and hiding information and trying not to tell people what we do. We're in the business of sharing that information and shouting from the rooftops just what all those benefits are. So back to that checklist, which I've put back down over there, that's the bare minimum. And we will use it to go through to make sure you haven't missed things. That was the blue one. Oh, it's here, no, it's here. This one here. This goes through, and we'll use it to go, have we made sure we've ticked all the boxes, you haven't left anything out? But it is just the bare minimum. It's not all the other things which you maybe feel are important to your charity or to your audience that really need to be in there to keep that going. So the article I mentioned was in The Spectator, but in Northern Ireland, I suppose we want to subject ourselves to the local media test. And when you're looking at what you put out there in the public domain and what you're reporting, say, if the BBC or the ITV or the Belfast Telegraph troll through the accounts and reports you file, will they have any unanswered questions? And if they visit your website, will those questions still remain unanswered? So I think that's a useful test when you're looking back at the information you're putting out there. So the figures that I as an accountant get so hung up about won't tell you the whole story. So you should really be taking every opportunity to do that, whether it's in your trustee's annual report, your public benefit statement, your website, or indeed your in-house and other publications.